Aloha. It is Tuesday, May 22nd. This is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. We continue to see how small businesses are bracing for tariffs, not just for goods made in Asia, but in Europe, too. How could trade negotiations in that part of the world affect the bottom line for a local textile business? We hear about how short-term rentals are complying with new rules to rein them in. And we take you to a new pedestrian overpass that just opened, a public-private partnership to help advance the Kaka'ako mantra of live, work, and play with safety as a centerpiece. Plus, we hear more about hula abroad, growing island culture and connections in, of all places, Kentucky. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. You know, we've been checking the pulse of many industries as a result of threatened double and triple digit tariffs. Today, we're taking you behind the scenes of a micro factory. Noho Home is a local textile business that seems to have been doing all the right things to become more resilient during these uncertain times. Jaylene Kanani is a creative force behind the company. We recently paid a visit to tour her micro factory in Waipio.
Well, we have an assortment of decor pillows. We have kitchen linens, so everything from tablecloths to napkins, placemats, table runners. We also have throws that we make. We make what we call a travel wrap. And then also specialty items. We make plant pots. We love to do that in collaboration with events. We just did the Polynesian Voyaging Society's 50th anniversary. That was super cute as a table centerpiece. Aprons, we're currently doing for some chefs. And yeah, it's a large assortment, and we can kind of turn on a dime and ideate something anytime we want. So some days we'll decide that we're going to dedicate it to looking at our scrap fabric and deciding what we can make out of it. So can we make little earbud pouches, or can we make clutches? Can we make a bag? Can we make bowl holders, refrigerator ties? There's just all kinds of things that I love when the team is able to be creative and come up with new products. And that really was the point of the micro factory, to be able to ideate quickly, develop proof of concept, test, and have as much design and storytelling to create connection as, you know, humanly possible for us.
Okay, and so what percentage of your products are made here, and what percentage do you have to go overseas?
So it would vary in the sense of, if you did it by units, the majority of product by units is going to be made in Hawaii. The majority of revenue would be from our overseas products. And that's because they are the higher ticket items.
Right. The rugs, yes. The carpets.
Yes, exactly. So we have our 100% comb cotton sateen sheets and duvet covers and comforters. So while we also make duvet covers here in our micro factory, we make them for interior designers who are doing, you know, pretty high-end projects, and the cost is about 3x of what our retail offering is.
It's custom.
Yes, exactly.
And the Noho team includes 13 workers behind the Ala Moana retail space and the Waipio textile factory. Jaylene Kanani offers a glimpse of the struggles during these uncertain times over the tariff wars, first with China and other countries in Asia, and now the latest news that President Trump is threatening European countries with double-digit hikes.
I design commercial textiles and other FF&E, so furniture, fixture, and equipment. It stemmed out of a necessity. I didn't plan it that way. I had worked in FF&E and working with architects and interior designers to specify and sell commercial products to predominantly the hotels. And what I quickly found out is that there really were not aesthetics that spoke in any authentic way to our history, lifestyle, values, flora, fauna. And so that's really how I started designing, was just to fill a need and a gap, especially in the commercial space. And there really wasn't anything like readily available on a shelf. I think it, you know, when I started 25 years ago, it was still kind of very craft fair back then, you would say, like craft fair and pop-up, where you could really find things that had connection and authenticity. And, you know, fast forward, we have a lot of Hawaiian designers who are, you know, taking their products and scaling it and sharing it on, you know, much larger platforms.
And so when you started designing things and then producing them, did you have to go offshore, or did you actually manufacture and make things here?
Well, our goal is to manufacture here. We have no raw materials in the textile space, right? We don't grow cotton. Even if we had cotton, we don't mill it, we don't spin it, we don't weave it. There are very few factories in the United States that do it at this juncture. So all of that grayish material or base material comes from overseas. So our goal was Hawaii production, and we continue to do that to today. But I think there needs to be a really keen understanding that we don't have a supply chain of raw materials in Hawaii and very little in the USA. I'll put an exclamation on that, because we purchase from suppliers in the USA. Those suppliers are middlemen. They are bringing in massive quantities of raw, you know, textiles, you know, white textiles, and then divvying it up to smaller companies who don't have, you know, the, like us, that don't have the storage or the ability to, you know, purchase 100,000 yards at a time. But they are the middlemen, so they actually also have to go overseas to source their products. So as far as cotton goes, it's China, India, Pakistan, Turkey, and, you know, the list goes on into, you know, smaller percentages in different regions, and also the USA. Interesting fact, in the USA, the cotton that's grown is almost, I believe, 80% shipped overseas as raw cotton, because of the lack of processing facilities to even work with the cotton. I think a lot of people don't realize the global implications of manufacturing a product, even in the United States. There still is so much global implication of upstream supplies chain that really is important to have, you know, consideration over.
And so we're sitting here in your warehouse space, and you have a number of employees that are hard at work.
Yeah, so this is actually our microfactory. So while we're in a warehouse space, it is an active microfactory. We practice make on small batch and make on demand. It's a philosophy called mass customization. Basically, we're trying to create as much design with the minimum amount of waste. So we have a very small batch approach and even make on demand. So that allows us to innovate the space. So the type of manufacturing that we do when we are applying pattern to our textiles is actually a waterless process, because the dyeing or coloring of fabric is actually 20% of the world's water pollution. So this non-water application is our, you know, sustainable small batch approach. We can do everything here, from design to graphics to our printing, our pressing, our cutting, which we do via a laser. We laser cut, and sewing and packaging. We can do that all here, and, you know, we can go from start to finish in 30 minutes.
So what about the machinery? Like, where did you get all your equipment?
Yeah, excellent question. Most of the textile industry's machinery comes from overseas. So you have China being the number one country of export for machinery. But then we also have Italy, we have Germany, we have Mexico, we have the Dominican Republic. There is truly global need for specialized machinery. Typically, they're all patented kinds of equipment, and so they're going to be pretty niche. that actually inhibits the ability to like quickly pop up with a new factory. I'm a fly on the wall with a much larger company, you know, a global company. It's a U.S. company who sells globally. And they said, okay, let's try to solution this by popping up, you know, a $30 million factory. And the challenge is that all of the needs of the building itself and the equipment were going to be impacted by supply chain and overseas tariffs. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's just a real dicey period right now.
It is. It feels like every day is a new day. There's a lot of pivoting. It really requires you to be resourceful and nimble and look for the opportunity, because really that's what we hold on to, right? Like, what opportunity can we see in this moment to, you know, create some value?
You seize the day, right?
Yes.
So if times are tough, you innovate and get resourceful.
Exactly. That's really all you can do. Being a small business, that's the one thing that might be great, is you can actually maybe pivot a little bit more. But really everything else is kind of a challenge, right? Because in order to pivot, you need resources. As it stands, you are already paying 30% more for everything unexpectedly. And that's really the key, is that it was unexpected.
And you're really at the mercy of forces outside your control.
Absolutely. You know, the geopolitical spectrum is moving so quickly. The powers that be, the people who represent small business, are actually not small business. When you think about it, right? The people who are in DC lobbying for small business are actually large business. So take into consideration Goldman Sachs, who has an amazing program and are, you know, lobbying on behalf of 10,000 small businesses, right? And of which I am one. And they do that work. But it is almost philanthropic work because they are Goldman Sachs.
That's the reality of being a small business in the global economy, I guess, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's something I've been pondering on quite a bit, is, you know, is there small business for small business, right? And what could that look like from a point of power and voice? Because really, small business, I believe the statistic is something like makes up 80% of the employers. In the small moments in which I have other things to think about than keeping the lights on, I like to kind of deep dive into, you know, how could we become more cohesive as small business? But also, I share in circles that as a small business, you don't have a tremendous amount of time to dedicate to things that seem beyond your power, right? To lobby. Yeah.
So you're just taking it, what, one day at a time? I mean, because the on and off tariffs, and you're trying to plan.
Most definitely one day at a time. And you know, if I were having cocktails with my girlfriends, this might be a very different conversation. But professionally, you know, I encourage my staff to always come with solutions and not complaints. So I position my conversation in, you know, in a way that, how can we look at the work on the plate today and pivot, adjust, find our opportunities, find where we can continue to exist and hopefully thrive, and, you know, make it through this turbulent time. Hope that it's shorter than longer. This morning, I spent the morning with my banker. You know, we've seen the degradation of the relationships with China. So, you know, we've looked at diversifying, right? Diversifying's great. And so we did that. But now it is a global scenario that we're looking at. And so those locales that we diversified to are in the same boat. To a lesser degree, they don't have as high a tariff. But yeah, so this morning I found out that I need to come up with $50,000 more than I needed to yesterday. So
that's the harsh reality.
That is the harsh reality, 100%.
That was a designer, Jaylene Kanani of NoHo Home, sharing her story, going from a cottage industry and trying to scale up with her micro-manufacturing business with state-of-the-art laser equipment. You know, we have been asking how these trying tariff times are affecting you, and we heard from a small business owner on our talkback line.
Hi, my name is Lori, and I live on Maui, Haiku area. I was listening, and I heard that you're doing a segment on the tariffs and how it's affecting folks, and I'm kind of affected by them. I have a small business. I sell little crystal sun catchers at the Upcountry Farmers Market, and I get my little crystals from a company, a small company in China, and I can't get them anymore. They can't even ship them to Hawaii. The FedEx and all of those companies have not figured out how to get their tariff thing worked out to where they can ship them to me. So I don't know what's going to happen. I guess I'm, at some point, either they're going to fix it or I'm going to run out of the crystals that are the heart of my business at the farmer's market. Anyway, thank you for your time. Aloha.
And thank you, Lori, for sharing your story with us. Are you a small business owner facing your own difficulties because of uncertain tariffs like Lori? We would like to hear from you. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or call our talkback line and record something, 808-792-8217.
Nearly 200 businesses across the state rely on HPR underwriting to reach engaged listeners like you. Mahalo to Kamuela Philharmonic, Sutter Health Kahi Mohala, and First Hawaiian Bank. They believe, just as you do, in the power of public radio. See a full list of our underwriters at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle-Tacoma Airport. More information at AlohaAirCargo.com.
Tune to the conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, oahu, umolokai, ulanai, umau, ukahoolabe, uhawai.
In a nod to Memorial Day, today's backyard quiz takes us back to World War II, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in 1941. 2 active ships were lost, the USS Oklahoma and the USS Arizona. The Arizona was too devastated by a massive explosion caused by the bomb that crashed through the deck of the ship, igniting its forward magazine. Nearly 80% of the crew was lost, most entombed in the sunken ship. The site of the wreck was a memorial as passing ships paid honors to the Arizona and its crew. It would be another 17 years before efforts became serious about building a memorial in the place where that ship had sunk. In 1958, President Dwight Eisenhower signed a law that allowed the Pacific War Memorial Commission to raise money to construct a memorial to the Arizona. Initial efforts to raise the $500,000 required to build the selected design got off to a fast start, but stalled in 1960 after $155,000 had been raised. And that is when one entertainer stepped in to help raise the rest of the money. On March 25th, the entertainer in question performed at the Block Arena at Pearl Harbor before an enthusiastic crowd that paid ticket prices ranging from $3 to $100. That event was a success and raised the rest of the funds required to build a memorial. For today's backyard quiz, we're asking, who was that entertainer who helped raise those funds? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
Compliance. That was a big city administration priority at the height of the crisis around illegal short-term rentals years ago. Still, the problem persists. Honolulu Civil Beat has been running a series of stories about how a crackdown and new regulations are faring. And here to talk about that is reporter Ben Angarone. Good morning, Ben.
Morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good, good. So, yeah, you did some digging. What did you find?
Yeah, so we did some digging. And the most recent story that published today, we found that short-term rentals are not allowed in a lot of areas of Oahu, but they are allowed in some areas like resort zones, most famously like Waikiki and Turtle Bay. And for a while, the city was having trouble, I think, getting people to actually register those legal rentals in these areas. And after streamlining the regulations last year for registrations, they found that the number of people who registered actually went up. But there still are a lot of people who, even though they run short-term rentals in what would be legal areas, they still have not registered their properties, which means they get to pay lower property taxes. And some of their neighbors who do register are a little bit annoyed that they don't have to pay these higher tax rates.
Yeah, so how is the city managing all this?
Yeah, the way that this is supposed to work is, if I live in Waikiki or if I own a property in Waikiki, I'm supposed to and I rent it out as a short-term rental, I'm supposed to register it, and the city can see that and everything. What the city has been focusing enforcement-wise instead is in these more residential areas like Kailua and everything, just as a result of not having as much manpower, I think, as they would like to have. And so as they focus on where do we do our enforcement, they're doing a more complaint-based focus, where if somebody calls up and says, hey, this house in Kailua is running an illegal short-term rental, and it's really bothering me and my neighbors, that's the ones that the city really focuses on, rather than these properties in the legal areas who just are not registering. So it's kind of a priorities kind of thing that they're trying to balance. And I think one of the ways I phrased it in the story is it sort of shows the difficulty of policing in an economy that's very tourism-focused.
Yeah, I can imagine, though, that the people who are registering and paying, doing the right thing, it's not fair to them when they've got other scofflaws in the district.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I talked to a few people over who own units over at Kualima Estates East, which is up at Turtle Bay. And that's the sort of vibe that I got from them. They said, it really bothers us because we're doing everything the right way. We registered our properties. We're paying higher taxes. We're following, for example, there's also occupancy limits, something like, you can only put two guests in each bedroom and everything. But if you don't actually register your property, then you can sort of skirt around these rules. And so this is something that even came up at the HOA meeting last month for Kualima Estates East. The homeowners association said in their meeting, like, hey, guys, we really need you to register your properties, because even though the city's not enforcing it yet, they will eventually, and also if you don't, we might have more people coming in than we expect, which means there's more guests in the pool area, there's more guests at whatever, common facilities they have. And so even for the homeowners associations that do allow short-term rentals, they're still trying to register them and get them regulated in some sort of fashion.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, we've just grappled with this situation for so long, and we're finally making some headway. But yeah, you wish that there would be more compliance.
Yeah. And it's sort of interesting how the city's trying to go about this. I think last week or the week before, I published another story about how the city has this big compliance tool that some other cities use to great effect of holding the platforms liable for the listings that they have. And the city just has not exercised this tool in any sort of way. What is written into law is that the platforms like Airbnb and Vrbo, they're supposed to register with the city. They're supposed to submit monthly reports of the listings that they have and the people's registration numbers, et cetera. But the city's not even enforcing that. No monthly reports have been submitted. No platforms have been registered, which means that, you know, the city can't take away their registrations and everything. And so in some ways, the city is correct in that it lacks some of the manpower required to enforce every single one of these regulations. But it's simultaneously true that they do have this big tool that they're just not using.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But thank you so much, Ben.
Thanks, Catherine. Have a good one.
All righty. We've been hearing from Honolulu Civil Beat's Ben Angarone. You can find this story that he talked about online at civilbeat.org.
Today on The Daily. After the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, abortions in the United States actually went up. In part, that's because of a novel legal strategy that ended up pitting blue states against red states. I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
Welcome back to The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Safety is behind a pedestrian overpass that spans Mauka to Makai over the Mauka side of Nimitz Ala Moana, connecting to Kewalo Basin and the entrance to Ala Moana Beach Park. HPR was there for the blessing of that bridge last week.
Aloha, aloha mai. Aloha, mahalo ke akua me ke aloha pomehana, e malama ho'o mai ka kohe malumau. Kia kua again, now we say thank you for the aina of where now this bridge stands. Kia kua, we mahalo for everybody that was mentioned and even those that had a dream maybe 50 years ago. We wish we could build something like this. Today, it has become a reality. And so when we untie that lei, mahalo kia kua for your touch upon every person that will walk across this bridge, every person that will drive under this bridge. Kia kua, may there just be a spark of a dream of life, of health, of goodness for every person that either walks across or rides a bike or drives underneath. May your aloha spirit be pono now and forevermore. Mahalo, mahalo, mahalo.
So far this year, fatalities on our highways and roadways are almost three times what we were at the same point last year. In fact, a deadly crash between a car and pedestrians took place not far from that pedestrian bridge. The $26 million project was largely paid for by federal funds, with $4 million from the state and still more from developer Howard Hughes. Here's State Transportation Director Ed Sniffen talking about the big picture, as this bridge is the latest piece for growth in this area.
Now, the reason that it's in this location, when we start looking at where we are, you'll see significant growth on the Mauka side in the units coming up. There's going to be a lot more people crossing in this area. Also, it connects up to where the city is going to be putting in a long-term pedestrian path and the rail station in the future. With this, our city partners are going to be putting in a rapid line that's connected to rail to ensure that we use this location for all those different purposes. So we know there's going to be significant usage in this area, which is why we partner here. And last is, we partnered in this area because Howard Hughes stepped up and said, we'll be your partner. We'll make sure that we help you fund this project to ensure we move it forward quickly.
And they're going to be maintaining the area around it, correct?
Absolutely. If it's up to the DOT, we're going to build you a structure to get you across safely, long term. When we work with Howard Hughes, they're looking at making sure that structure ties into the land. And you can see from the architecture here, there's significant vegetation, structures, beautifications that normally wouldn't go into a DOT project if we're using public funds for it. they're going to be taking care of that vegetation, the lighting on the structure, security that's necessary on the structure long term, and all those costs are going to be borne by them, not by the DOT. So significant.
On the safety issue, I know another person died on our highways. I mean, we're almost three times what we were, at the same time last year. Any message you want to get out to the public?
Yes, we got to start taking care of each other. I mean, the difficulties that I'm seeing on the system right now is we cannot find a hot spot to start targeting. It's everywhere. Significant speeding is everywhere. Drug driving is everywhere. Distraction is everywhere. We need everybody to start taking it as their own responsibility to take care of themselves, everybody in their vehicle, and all their friends and family that are walking and biking on the roadways right now. Right now, we're seeing that of those fatalities on our roadway, there are two times those that are not in vehicles that are being killed on the system than those that are in vehicles. Significant numbers showing that our most vulnerable are at risk every time we get out there. The public should understand, the most dangerous thing that you can do during your daytime, during your day on Hawaii, is to drive. The only thing more dangerous is to walk and bike. And all of those is because we are not aware of each other. We got to make sure we're connected again.
And during last week's blessing, the city's Deputy Transportation Director, John Noucci, underscored the significance of this critical piece of infrastructure for the future.
A great day for safety, for pedestrians, and for bikes, and even those using the highway. And it's consistent with Ed's vision of safety and just safer streets for all statewide. And we're lucky to be here today, standing on what is already iconic and will prove to be iconic in the future. This pedestrian bridge that was not a minimal bridge. Look at the beauty of all the landscaping and all the art and the other cues that combine together to make this a great place. And, it shows that we are not limited to dreaming minimally, that we can dream big and we can achieve realistically these big dreams. So I will always say, whenever Ed and I get to cross paths at an event like this, that things are good in the kingdom because our federal, state, city, and community partners are aligned and unwavering in their commitment, in our commitment to safety and projects which enhance already great communities. So in the past, Hawaiians relied on the resilience of the land division that we know as the Ahupua'a. And they relied on that to provide everything they needed in resilience, from the mountain valley to the bounty of the ocean via clean streams. And this bridge is really a symbol of that vision of what we can call our 21st century Ahupua'a. And it emphasizes our city and all of our partners' commitment to enhance that walkability and connections in our neighborhoods from Mauka to Makai. And that is totally in concert with our Complete Streets and Vision Zero program. So we could not be happier that this bridge is going to open today.
And Representative Darius Kila is the Transportation Committee Chair. He acknowledged the long road to get to this point, from the supply chain issues for the concrete work to overcoming other delays.
So to the partners that are here today, the construction company that stayed through the project to see it through, and to what has been said, our city partners, I'm so grateful to be at the legislature during a time where it's looking for collaboration and not challenges. So as we look forward, it is a great time to be at the DOT, be in the state. Every dollar that we are investing is going to improve the lives of our residents. So whether it's in Nanakuli, Kaka'ako, Maui, Hawaii Island, or Kauai, we are doing everything we can to improve the lives of the communities that we get to serve. So to the pedestrian bridge that is here and the pedestrian bridges that are to come, I look forward and I'm excited. I won't probably use it. As Ed said, I flew in from Nanakuli. But it's about the generations to come. Acknowledging very much well the investments we make today are for the generations in the future to come. So I'm sure 10, 20 years from now, when the residents who are living here that are applying for these homes, that are getting to come in with affordable housing, they can raise their families in a safe space, in a safe community.
And there is still more to come in this critical corner where high-rise tower after high-rise towers are taking shape. Here's Howard Hughes President Doug Johnstone about the vision for additional open park space, more than 3 acres, for what is envisioned as a magnet for a growing community.
We jumped in really to help with some of the design elements, coordinate a lot of the different parties, and contribute land that connected with what's one of our main open spaces within Ward Village, known as Victoria Ward Park. So we opened this Makai section of Victoria Ward Park a few months ago now, and the elevated walkway is really meant to improve bike and pedestrian connectivity to Kewalo Harbor, Ala Moana Beach Park, and provide a really safe, comfortable crossing over what's typically, you know, a pretty busy corridor for Honolulu. And, you know, I think the long-term vision is ultimately expanding this park space Mauka quite a bit to be about 3.5 acres in size. It really acts as a focal point of open space, gathering opportunities. There's going to be a playground. There's going to be tons of restaurants and shops lining the perimeter of it. And especially in an urban setting where we're trying to perpetuate smart growth and bring together a new neighborhood in the middle of town, areas like this that have shade, open space, safety, and an ability to get out in nature is really vital.
And so you folks are basically going to step up, and this is going to be your kuleana. You're going to maintain this area.
Yeah, so with our parks, open space, street frontages, and this elevated walkway as well, you know, one of the opportunities we have as a master plan developer is to really take care of this overall campus or district, working with the residents, the shops and restaurant owners and everything like that. We have district security, we have consistent landscaping, maintenance, things like that, that really acts as a nice way to keep, you know, what's a basically a public and private canvas in really good shape.
I think there's a concern that you might get, you know, homeless camps that we saw form over in Kaka'ako, and you just want to be able to manage them.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, a lot of what I think helps the streetscapes and the public realm here is just the activity itself. You know, obviously safety is a huge focus of ours and our residents and visitors, but, you know, the amount of people walking along the streets, the lighting, the security cameras, and just that vibrancy, I think, is one of the things that helps to add, you know, a lot of those elements that make it comfortable and safe to walk around at all areas of the day or night.
And you've got kiosks here, so I imagine then that's an area for vendors.
Yeah, so over on the plaza portion on Oahu Street, we have a few kiosks that are in place, and we're hoping to get, you know, prepackaged food and beverage and kind of like light picnic style things that can help to activate that corner and, you know, bring kind of light footprint retail to the park space.
And then talk about what you have planned for Oahu, because eventually the city will open that up for access.
Sure. So the big idea with Oahu Street really began over by where South Shore Market is. And this goes back 10, 12 years when we completed that corner. And it's really meant to add bike lanes within the roadway, add a landscape buffer that provides a setback from where cars and bikes are and a safe, comfortable pedestrian walkway up against where retail is. And it's always been envisioned to have Oahu Street be as the main promenade within Ward Village. And incrementally, as we're completing projects moving EVA, we're continuing that section or that streetscape that really improves your ability to walk and bike from one end to the other. And the biggest change that's gonna happen really in the next year or so is where Oahu Street used to dead end over by the former Bank of Hawaii building and so forth, it's actually gonna shift up Mauka at Ward Avenue and connect to Pohukaina Street. And that'll allow it to continue toward downtown and create a lot of linkage throughout Kaka'ako.
And then the remaining area in that cul-de-sac at Oahu, then that will become more of a plaza?
Correct. So that's meant to be another plaza or mini park space that'll complement a project called the Launiu that we've been designing and moving forward there. You know, today was a great day, and, you know, a chance to really see how many people touch projects like this. You know, it was a really good example of collaboration with so many different technical disciplines, construction industry, city and state agencies. And to us, it's something to be proud of, where we can all come together and improve Honolulu.
And that was a snippet of the long-awaited grand opening of a new pedestrian bridge near Kewala Basin and the vision of what's to come in our Honolulu with Kaka'ako Rising. For today's quiz, we asked you to identify the entertainer who helped raise the necessary funds to build the USS Arizona Memorial. On March 25th, 1961, he gave a concert and insisted that everyone who attended paid none of the usual comps for military VIP. In fact, the performer bought a $100 ticket himself and dozens more to give to staff and patients at the military hospital. Recognize this voice?
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to do the very first record that we ever made. This was for the Sun Record people. in Memphis, Tennessee when we first started out. I hope you remember, it's called, That's All Right, Mama.
That's right. It was the king himself, Elvis Presley. And that was him on the very night of the concert to benefit the USS Arizona on March 25th, 1961. He performed a 15-song set that lasted 45 minutes. It was one of the longest live sets of his career, and it would be another 8 years before he would perform live again. And our winner today, Adam from Honolulu, you got it right. We got lots of calls. People knew the Elvis connection. But that's our quiz. If you have an idea for one, please send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
In his epic composition, The Lightbringer, Hawaii Symphony composer-in-residence Michael Thomas Fumai portrays an epic battle between good and evil. Tell me, what was the genesis of this piece, The Lightbringer?
Well, this is a piece that really starts with the title, The Lightbringer, and it has to do with the devil, an unsavory figure in Christianity, and it is something I was always very interested in because I was brought up Catholic and read Revelations and, you know, was kind of trying to picture the genesis of what would become the devil. And so I wanted to write music that really foretold this battle of the angels that we see in that chapter of the Bible. And that's what The Lightbringer is.
Stand firmly on the side of good by supporting 24 hours of classical music each and every day on HPR2. Visit HawaiiPublicRadio.org to donate.
It is best known for the Kentucky Derby, or perhaps the Bourbon Trail, but Louisville, Kentucky will also hold its first Polynesian Cultural Festival this weekend. It's hosted by Hui Akaululehua, a small school that was started by a Hawaiian living in the diaspora. HPR contributor Betsy Brown spoke with Kyla Chun, the director of the group. They start with how the group got its name.
Kaululehua is the name of a wind, actually from Hawaii Island, but also we are named by our kumu. So my kumu hula is Kumukabika Aofichi of Halau o Ke Kealii in San Francisco, California. His halau is called Halau o Ke Kealii.
So how long have you been doing hula?
It has been a little over 10 years, I think. I think this year will be my 11th year. I've lived in Louisville for 25 years and not super connected to my Hawaiian culture. I have never lived in Hawaii or grown up there. But I was looking for just something very specific. I was hoping for one hula dance for an event and was trying to find anyone who could teach me. And there happened to be someone here locally. Her name is Marie Grinstead, and she taught classes regularly. And so I started with her with a group called Ike Roa. And then when COVID started, I started taking online classes with my kumu when he started offering classes on Zoom.
That must have been interesting.
Yes, learning any dance, I think, especially hula on a camera, is tricky. Kumu makes it look easy teaching on Zoom. It is not easy, having tried it. Yeah, it's not the easiest thing. And part of hula is being connected to the people that you're dancing with and being together. And that can be hard, but it was such a lifesaver through that time being at home and being isolated. So
you said you've been here 25 years. So you probably moved here with your family.
Yes. Yeah. Both of my parents were in the Army. And so not a ton of moves, but we moved around a little bit. And then we settled here in Louisville.
Why did your family end up settling here instead of going back to the islands?
Yeah. So my dad is from Hawaii. He was born in Honolulu. My grandfather's from Oahu and my grandma's from Kauai. And so we have family there. But I don't think that it was ever really an option that was on the table for them. We moved to Louisville for an assignment my mom had with work, and my dad came for some higher education, and we settled here. And I don't know that it was ever a thought, but my parents joke when we would visit, my mom would say, I want to live here. This is so perfect. It would be so great to be here. And my dad would say, it's an island. Where are you going to go? What are you going to do? And it's funny now because he has since joined our hui. He's part of our ho'opa and he is learning to dance. And I think he would say something very differently now.
How does living in Louisville, which isn't even near the ocean, affect your identity as a Hawaiian?
Yeah. I think living as a Hawaiian in the diaspora, it looks different for every kanaka oʻiwi, but it is hard to feel connected to land that you have never lived on. And when we go home, when I go to Hawaii, I feel that in my body and my soul. This is a home that I've never lived on. And so to be far away from that can be really difficult. And I think there's a lot of feelings of maybe I'm not Hawaiian enough, or I have to learn more before I can say, oh, I've reached this place where I feel like I'm Hawaiian enough. I think all Hapa folks and people who are living in the diaspora probably have some sense of that. But hula helps me and folks in our hui to create that connection, to transport to places that we want to be and want to connect to.
What do you mean by that, by transport to a different place?
Yeah, hula is about storytelling, right? We're telling some new stories, but also a lot of old stories, but all stories of Hawaii, of our aumakua, of our ali'i, of our ancestors and the people who have come before us, and all of these cultural practices and these beautiful stories that we want to pass down. And so learning those stories and learning what hula means to Hawaiian culture and connecting to each other in the group through that helps to give us a connection to places that we've never been or stories that we're hearing secondhand. But it really is this element of transport, of being able to connect you across the ocean.
Have you had students who are Hawaiian?
The hui has been around since June of 2022, and it feels every year we get new folks who are Hawaiian or Polynesian. They're from other parts of Polynesia. And it feels like there are just always people who come out of the woodwork to say, I didn't know this existed in Louisville. And yeah, a lot of our folks in the hui are regular students, are kanaka oʻiwi or, like I said, from other parts of Polynesia. And it feels we're an ohana, we're a family and a safe place for people to come and be themselves and experience their culture. And my hila hilo are very no shame about the way that you come or the way that you know, what you bring to the group. And so there are folks who have grown up with a lot of rich Hawaiian tradition in their family, and there's folks who know that they're Hawaiian, but that's the extent of what they know. And so we're all like learning and growing here together, which is really amazing.
What's your ultimate goal for the students in your hui?
Yeah. My kumo says, we talk a lot about hula as storytelling, but the ultimate purpose of hula is healing. And I think for me, becoming a hula person and engaging in hula on a regular basis has been really transformative for me. I'm learning a lot about myself as I look outside of just me and I look to my aumakua and my kupuna and this really incredible hula lineage that we have. And there's a healing that happens for me every time that I dance and every time that I'm here with this group. And that's what I want for everyone who comes in. We all need healing in some capacity. We all need that connection and that transformation. And whether you're Hawaiian or not, that can happen for you when you experience hula. And so that's my highest goal.
What do you think your ancestors would think about what you're doing?
My kumu has said before, you're on a path now and you can try to step off it if you like, and your aumakua are going to come and let you know that you're off the path and put you back on it. And I feel that really deeply. I think this experience is bringing me home to people I never had the honor of knowing, but who are guiding me and transforming who I am. And I feel a lot of pride and a lot of people standing behind and in front of me through this journey. And it's, yeah, really special.
When you say home, what do you picture?
I think even before dancing hula, home has always been my feet in the sand and looking out at the ocean and just the settling that happens in my chest and in my body when I'm in Hawaii. I have a lot of hopes for the Lahui, the Hawaii Nation, and regardless of what happens with that, I think home is that feeling and being physically connected to the aina and experiencing life there is the ultimate goal, I think, for so many of us who live far away.
And you have some exciting events planned. Can you talk about the Polynesian Festival?
Yeah. So we are hosting our first, I think probably Louisville's first Polynesian cultural festival at the end of May of this year. It's called Alohalu. And our goal is just to bring folks together. We're going to have a really great lineup of Polynesian dancers and musicians to present different types of Polynesian dance. So we've got hula and siva and ori tahiti. And we're going to have a lot of different vendors and food, and we're just trying to create a space where folks who are in the diaspora can come together and celebrate and connect and experience home away from home, but also an opportunity for the larger community to experience that aloha as well, and to feel that love and to experience the excitement and healing of hula that we want to offer people. So we're really excited to be doing that for the first time.
How far away do you expect people to come from?
Yeah, Mike Kumo's coming. He's coming from San Francisco, and we have some performers coming, traveling from Chicago and Fort Knox. The local Kentucky Army base has a large Polynesian community, and so we're hoping a lot of those folks will come out. And yeah, I don't know. It's like I said, it feels like folks come from all over the place. And places that you wouldn't expect, oh, there are Hawaiians here? Like, people just show up.
That was Kyla Chung and HPR contributor Betsy Brown. Chung is the director of Hui Ka'ulu Lehua, a Hawaiian cultural group based in Louisville, Kentucky. The group is hosting its Polynesian Cultural Festival in Louisville, which takes place on Saturday, May 31st. That does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear from coffee growers about the tariff uncertainty. Share your comments or questions about what you heard by calling our talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.